Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. I just got back from Uganda, where I was working with Sawyer Products to distribute water filters in several communities. And it was such a powerful reminder of how life-changing access to clean water is, as well as how many people don't actually have that. So before we get into today's episode, I want to give a special thank you to John G. for their continued support of the FKT podcast, but also because beyond making durable trail running apparel, they also donate 2% of sales to clean water programs in all the places we run. John G has donated over $1 million to clean water and counting. Shop their gear at johng.com and use code FKT for 10% off. Join me today as I talk with Rachel Bambrick about her recent unsupported Batona Trail FKT. Learn about her philosophy on setting first known times, what to do with brown water, and her quest to get sponsored by Smuckers. Thanks, Rachel, so much for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm super excited and honored to be here as well.
So you recently set an FKT on the Batona Trail in New Jersey, which is a 50-mile trail. And I think most people that aren't familiar with New Jersey would just think about all the major cities, lots of people, lots of traffic. And maybe if they think about a trail, they think about the Appalachian Trail. So can you describe what the Batona Trail is like and like kind of paint a picture for people who haven't actually been to New Jersey or to that part of New Jersey?
Yeah, absolutely. I think folks from New Jersey or in the area know New Jersey can often get kind of like a bad rap, or it's, you know, there's not too much going on there, people will say, but there's really a beautiful trail network all going through the Pine Barrens. So an area stretching across New Jersey. The Batona Trail runs 53 miles through that, and it's a beautifully open trail. It's nice and clear and flat. There's a lot of sandy sections, so the Pine Barrens end up, there's a lot of sand within the trail, but that kind of just makes for like a unique environment. Lots of pine needle trees, even some sections with, I felt like I was in the Everglades at moments. You're walking across these little kind of like wooden bridges to get from like tree to tree to tree to go through this bigger like water crossing. So it's a really kind of beautiful and unique area that, like I think you said, I don't think a lot of people would expect to find that in New Jersey. So it's really special.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the Everglades because I used to live in Florida, and when I was looking at like your pictures and pictures from the Batona Trail Hiking Club's page, that was what kind of struck me, is it reminded me a lot of Florida and hiking in Florida, which also people don't understand what Florida looks like in the natural world. Another place where people are just picturing beaches, but it is a lot of like pine trees, like pine tree forest, and like this unique sandy dry environment. So yeah, it was interesting. Like I wouldn't have expected that in New Jersey either.
Yeah, it's a cool area, and I even haven't explored all of it, but just getting to see this bit of it was really nice.
And so you mentioned sand, and I have done some hiking in sand, and it's terrible. So I'm kind of curious, like, how did like the sand affect you? I mean, obviously you probably knew it was going to be there, but like, was it difficult? Like, how problematic is the sand on this trail?
Yeah, I don't think it's something that folks should be nervous, like overly nervous about or shy away from. I also think that I was a little bit lucky. I went the day after it had rained quite a bit, and then it was kind of rainy, a little like sleet in the beginning of my FKT. So the sand was a bit more packed. So I wasn't running through these like, yeah, when you run through that loose sand, you really just feel like you're pushing through nothing and not getting anywhere. I didn't have that much of that kind of experience because it was a bit more packed down just because of the weather conditions. But overall, I think you have a sandy section, but you get through it, and then you get back to this just really nice, soft, plush, pine needly ground underfoot. So while it does exist on the trail, and you can definitely say it's sandy, it's not something that I hope should deter people from exploring their own adventure there too.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I was just picturing like, yeah, some of the hiking I did do in Florida where it's just like mile after mile of sand. And I'm like, oh gosh, like get me out of here. But it does make sense what you're saying. Like when like there's moisture and stuff, and that helps pack it down. And so having it be intermittent, I think that makes a big difference.
Yes. That is huge. It's not sand the whole way by any means. You get spots, but you get out of it pretty quickly.
Sort of like the rocks in Pennsylvania, if anybody is familiar with hiking in Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
Like the whole state in rocks, even though it seems like it.
Yes.
I'm not sure where you live, but when I was looking up where the Batona Trail is, and maybe other people other than me
are more cognizant of the geography of New England, like this part of the world. Not even New England, but this part of the world. But this trail is actually located slightly south and west of Philadelphia. Like New Jersey sticks down quite a bit. So it's kind of an interesting, it was interesting to me to see that.
Yeah. And I live in Philadelphia. So I'm not even a local New Jersey and I can't have that claim, but I would take trips down to scout up the trail before doing it. And it's only about an hour from the city of Philadelphia. So you still have this access to this huge trail network in a different state, but still within an hour of a major city.
That's really amazing, like that it's so close and so accessible. Because I mean, I've been to Philadelphia, and it's like it seems like Philadelphia kind of goes on forever. And so to know that there's this like massive trail system there is really incredible. I mean, an hour's drive is nothing.
Yeah, it's a great. They were lucky to have, and having the Wissahickon in Philadelphia as well. I feel really blessed to live in a city, but also have some great trails.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Wissahickon is really nice. Obviously, you live in Philadelphia, so this is close by. Close trails. But I'm curious what prompted you to choose the Batona as an FKT, and specifically like an unsupported FKT, because you haven't really done a lot of FKTs. You're predominantly kind of like a racer, you know, ultras and things like that, marathons. So yeah, can you just like tell me a little bit about why you decided to tackle this, especially unsupported?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the reason for picking the trail is, I'll start with that. It's a less exciting story, but my husband went camping with one of his friends along the trail and came back and was like, you know, there's this trail. Maybe you should see if you should run it, or maybe do an FKT on it. And then as soon as someone tells me something like that, it's probably going to happen, because I get my mind on a mission. So that's where that inspired me doing the Batona Trail, and having it be local FKT, I thought seemed really accessible. But specifically choosing to do it unsupported, what I like to do when I'm looking at FKTs, and I think of them to me, instead of a fastest known time, I've started to shift, and I like to think of them as like a first known time. So I like to find areas where women haven't completed an FKT, whether they haven't completed the route or they haven't completed that style within the route. And I say that not because I'm looking for, you know, like an easy way to get the number one spot because I'm the only one. I say that because I like to find areas of gaps and filling that gap, showing that women can take on, whether it's the route or the style of FKT. I hope that by kind of placing that mark and getting it done myself, it inspires other women to see that they can do it as well. Hopefully they read my race report, they see my time, and they're inspired to get out there and take it down. That's what excites me about FKTs in general, is finding those first known times and establishing them and then encouraging others to take them on. Because I really think the more women that see themselves in this area, the more that we're going to continue to complete FKTs and set new routes and take down records. So that's what inspired doing the unsupported one specifically. And I think, like you said, this was a big difference for me. I'm someone who, I really like the crowds at races. I like the energy that I get from people. I love making friends at, say, aid stations during races. So choosing to do it unsupported was also a challenge to myself to see where I'm at in my ultra running journey, how I'm able to rely on myself, and to really see how I do with an adventure like this when I don't have that external energy that I often really seek within the sport, just to see what do I do and how do I rely on myself. So that was a really fun, different challenge for me that I'm hopeful to do more like that too.
So what did you end up thinking about doing an unsupported FKT of this distance?
Yeah, I think, to be in total transparency, there are moments right around the middle of the run, probably that when you just get past that halfway, that like 30-ish mile mark for this one, where, yeah, I would have loved to have seen an aid station and some people to chat to distract myself. But I think afterwards, that's where I felt like immensely proud of myself to see that I've been able to do that, to pick myself up in low spots completely on my own. It really felt like I kind of opened a new door for myself in like the world of ultra running. It's still a relatively new area for me, and I think I keep trying to find different challenges, and this one felt like kind of unlocking a new section and seeing how I'm able to manage on my own and being able to succeed and do that and pick myself up in low spots, rely completely on myself, carry one of the heavier packs I've ever carried, and still make it start to finish. I really liked it. I think I had, yeah, a lot of immense pride and that feeling of kind of stepping into a new realm of this ultra world, this FKT world.
Yeah. What was your previous longest unsupported jaunt? Like whether it was training or otherwise, do you have an idea? Like
completely unsupported outside of doing some long training runs, prepping, I ran the Cocodona 250 last year. So I would do some, maybe a 6 hour training run. And that was mostly on my own. But outside of that, this was my first kind of step into that area. I've had some long, you know, if within any ultra, you may have these long stretches where maybe you don't see anyone, but I would always know, just get to that next aid station. So this was definitely a big mental shift because there wasn't a next aid station. It was, how am I going to mentally break this down to keep myself going, knowing that I'm not going to see someone in 5 miles and 10 miles. I won't see someone until the end.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I love what you were saying about like feeling the sense of pride and accomplishment and being able to kind of pick yourself up and self-motivate, you know, because that's one of the things I really love about doing something unsupported or self-supported, you know, the longer efforts, because you really are like finding new levels of capability and strength in yourself. And you kind of have to if you want to be successful, if you want to keep going. So that's really cool.
Thank you.
So kind of shifting a little bit more to the actual like trail and the experience of it. You did this FKT in February, and February doesn't seem like the best time of year in this region, weather-wise. So what was the weather like? I mean, you mentioned it had been raining prior, but what was it like for you out there?
Yeah, I think you're completely right. February in the mid-Atlantic area is extremely iffy. It could be anything from 60 degrees and sunny to snow. But I prefer running in the chillier months overall compared to the summer in this area. So for me, it was always going to be either an early spring or maybe like a late fall attempt would be where I would feel the most comfortable. I did luck out. It was chilly overall, but I think it rested right around in the 40s, which was what all of my training days out in Batona had been as well. So I felt comfortable with the things I'd been trying out, the gear that I'd had. I had been obsessively following the weather forecast leading up to it, and it was clear, it was going to rain the day before, but be clear. Even that morning, I just saw like the little cloudy icons in the weather, and then I get out there and we're maybe 2 hours in or so, and I feel some raindrops. Okay, this is fine. A little while later, the rain becomes a lot steadier, and I had a rain jacket, so that was good. It's like, it said no rain. And then at a moment, I took a video because it was just so silly. It started sleeting, so I was hearing the difference in the sound, and it was that like raindrop sound, and then it was that hard sleet sound, and I looked up, I was like, oh, this is solid. So we had, luckily that only lasted about at most an hour of that kind of rain and then sleet and then back to rain, and then the skies opened up and I did have a nice, really just crisp end of February day, so that I got the reward in the end, but I was not anticipating that precipitation. But I think that's truly the nature of any kind of outdoor activity in this area. You never right. know what you're going to get in this like New England mid-Atlantic region, especially this time of year.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's good that you were prepared. You still had a rain jacket, even though it wasn't being called for. Was that hard for you like mentally at that point? Like to be like, oh my gosh, like I don't want to run in this. Like, or were you just kind of like, all right, well, I have the gear, I'm prepared. Like, did it kind of throw you for a loop at all?
I think more the latter. I think I had a rain jacket because, like I said, you never know. And knowing that it had rained the day before, I was like, there's always that chance. So I did have that prepared. But I truly, yeah, I took a little video and I kind of just panned across all the sleet and then turned the camera back on my face. And I just kind of shook my head and laughed because that's exactly how I felt in that moment. Like, I'm prepared. I've got gloves. I've got a jacket. I can't let this bother me now. The best thing to do is just laugh, look at the sky, and shake it off and keep going. So luckily that moment, I did not let that really get to me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really all you can do. Like, when you're out there, you're just like, there's nothing I can actually do to stop this. So, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you mentioned, obviously, you had a rain gear and that sort of thing. You said it was like the heaviest pack you've carried. What other types of gear did you bring with you? You know, like, can you kind of just briefly go over your kit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest piece that weighed down the pack was I carried 4 liters of water and then food. So I was trying to average roughly about 200 calories an hour. So for me, I'm not the fastest runner or FKTer out there. So that required a good amount of food to try to pack in there. I had a change of shirt, which I didn't end up using just in case I got too warm or it got too wet. I had my rain jacket. And then after that, it was primarily, I did have a battery block as well, just in case, because I was anticipating being out there roughly 12 hours. So just in case I got stranded, I wanted to have that kind of emergency piece. Outside of those major items, the rest of what was in my pack was just small piece, like a small bit of sunscreen, a small bit of anti-chafing balm. I had an emergency bivy just in case. It's just kind of those emergency items, some Advil, some salt pills. So those were the lighter ones. But the biggest piece was the hydration and the nutrition. And that was, I had some practice with a nearly as heavy pack, because the first section of the Cocodona 250 is about 37 miles with pretty minimal aid stations. So you do have to carry at least 3 liters of water for that. So I'd had practice with that from last year, but this was an additional bit plus the snacks and the other pieces that I was more relying on aid stations for in the past.
I mean, 4 liters seems like a lot of water. Is there no natural water on the Batona Trail? Is it a dry trail? Is that why you were carrying so much?
There is natural water along the trail. I had a filtration bottle, and I at one point tried to, so I learned a lot about the Batona Trail afterwards. I went to filter water because there's a good amount of natural sources. And when I'd done kind of recon missions to check out the trail, I'd noted where they all were, but I hadn't actually taken my bottle down to scoop the water and just see what it looked like until I was in the middle of it. So I got to about, I think, mile 38. I was getting a little lower on water, and I had a hydration mix in one of my bottles, and I wanted to lighten up my load. So I dumped out some of that, and then I went to go filter water, and the water came out it looked like iced tea. It came out this like deep, deep brown color. And I think some of this is just my own, I think, inexperience with doing a ton of water filtering. That made me super nervous. Even having the filtration bottle, it's, this is a color I'm not sure it should be. So I spent some time trying to find, you know, the areas with running water in this lake, still iced tea brown. And I wasn't certain what I should do about that. So at that point, I still had a few more hours to go in some water. So I just stuck the brown water in my pack just in case. And I kept going, and I made it through with just the water it started with. So that ended up being the correct amount, I think, for me to carry, because I was pretty low by the end. But after talking to some of my friends afterwards, I guess that the water will pretty much always be that color in the Batona area because of the sediment in the sand and the trees that lead into the lake. So it's not that it's, you know, super duper contaminated. It's just that's going to be the natural color of the water pretty much all along this trail. Not having practiced the actual filtering piece in my prep work, had not figured that piece out and got a little too scared about that, didn't want it to mess with my race. So I carried it with me, but I didn't end up drinking it, only to learn later that it would have been safe to do so.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you weren't really far off when you described it as iced tea, because it's the tannins in the leaves in the water, and that is why tea comes out that color. It's leaching tannins out of the tea leaves. So it really is, you know, I jokingly refer to a lot of the AT rivers as iced tea, rivers of iced tea, because the water is frequently quite brown if you aren't getting it from like a tiny spring-fed stream.
Yeah, it was a huge learning experience for myself. I think in both the FKTs I've done, I've had these moments where I was like, I thought I was so prepared. And then these things come up and you're just problem solving in the moment, trying to think it through. I hadn't had experience with that, but that's exactly what I learned afterwards. It's just the tannins, and I would have been perfectly fine, but I wasn't so sure about that iced tea water. But now I know for the future.
Definitely the first time I encountered that, I was the same. I was just like, I'm not drinking this. Yes. Brown water seems like a bad idea.
Yes. And there's yeah. one like tap on the course or the route. However, I'd seen it in one of my test runs and I was so excited because I knew it was about halfway. I could switch out all my water. I could carry a lighter load. I went up to the water pump and there were signs posted all around it saying, danger, E. coli, do not drink, like stay away. So there is a tap, a natural tap along the course, but at least to this point, it's not super safe to drink. So I left that one and stuck with natural sources.
You didn't mention a headlamp. Did you carry a headlamp? Were you out in the dark?
Yes, I did. That was my mistake to miss that. I started just after dawn. So it was light when I started, but really just lightening up. And then I probably spent about an hour and a half in the dark at the end. I finished in the dark and I used a waist lamp. Yes.
Okay. Because I thought I saw some of your pictures looked pretty dark. And I was like, did you do this without a light?
Oh, gosh.
Just running by moonlight.
It was actually a full moon, which was gorgeous to see. But
I bet.
Yeah, it was quite dark towards the end.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about your gear. We talked about the hydration. What you said you were taking in 200 calories an hour. What were you using as fuel? Like, what were you eating, or were you just doing liquid calories? Like, how did that look?
Yeah. So I tend to within an hour, I break that down into 2 half-hour chunks, and on one of those half-hour chunks, I take liquid calories. I just use Tailwind in my water, and this time I'd done a big mix of Tailwind in my bladder because I felt like that would be more efficient rather than carrying little packs of that. So that was an adjustment for this unsupported style. And then in terms of solid food, it's like an ultra runner smorgasbord, but I love Uncrustables. They are one of my favorite running fueling sources. I'm adamantly trying to get Smuckers to be like an ultra running sponsor or something, but they haven't responded to me yet. I will keep trying. I had Spring Energy. I really loved their awesome sauce. It just tastes like cinnamon applesauce. It's delicious. I had some Ruffles chips. I had some Fritos, and then Untappd. So it's just natural maple syrup in like a little packet. And they have a few. I had some that had caffeine and some that didn't. I also carried a few caffeine pills. So I think at about mile 35 or so, when I was getting a little bit low, a little bit in my head, had some of that, kind of boosted my energy up and kept going. So primarily Uncrustables and then some chips and some awesome sauce and some Tailwind.
When I was reading your trip recap, you mentioned that you felt safe the entire time. So I was kind of curious, like, why you mentioned safety? Like, were there like safety concerns going into it?
No, I really tried to call out and mention safety. I think, again, going back to the point of trying to establish female FKTs, I think safety is just a different sort of consideration that as a female runner, things that I would have to take into account that maybe some of my male counterparts wouldn't talk to. So I feel that when I'm writing a FKT report, that it's important for me to talk about like safety concerns. And I thought it was important, especially knowing that for maybe some runners like myself, we would be, if we're taking on the full distance, have to be running at night. And I felt safe throughout different times of day, throughout different spots along the course. You do go through some like camp areas. There are some areas where people might be parked and hanging out. And throughout the entire time, I didn't have any, you know, difficult encounters. I felt safe at night. That can always vary, but that was just an important piece for me to put in there. If there was another female runner reading my report, considering the trail, I would want them to know that. Same with my male counterparts too, of course. But to me, I think it's just a different consideration we have to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Did you see many people out there? Like, how popular is this trail?
I think it is a very popular trail, but I don't think it is in February.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think I saw a total of about 10 people throughout the whole, the 53 miles. So to me, that was not a whole ton on what started off as a not great day weather-wise, but turned into a really nice one. A lot of hikers, there are some people that do it as a through hike and camp along the way. But yeah, about 10 people, I think three dogs, and that was it. That and me and the water.
Right. So it was a lot of solitude out there.
Definitely.
So you were out there, you know, predominantly alone, you know, on this trail. And I'm kind of curious, like, how the navigation was. Like, is the trail well marked? Like, how do you know where you're going? Like, did you carry maps? Like, talk about how you didn't get lost, or did you get lost?
No. So I think one very unique, at least unique to me, component of the Batona Trail is it is extremely well marked. Like, it is like no other trail I've ever seen. If there are pink blazes along so many trees, if you go more than 30 seconds without seeing a pink blaze in your eye line, you're off trail, and you know it immediately because there it is so frequent. They also have mile markers posted every half mile, which is,
oh my gosh,
a whole thing to really deal with.
That would drive me insane.
Yes. I knew about this. I talked to a few people who had done it before. I knew that this was going to be there. I'd seen it on some of my recon missions, so to say. And you can tell they fully band the tree with a blaze. And then there's a wooden sign attached to it giving you those half mile markers. So you see it coming up. I just really tried my very best. If I could see it in the distance, I would keep my eyes averted to the actual number. So I would try to trick myself to not be seeing every half mile. But yeah, to answer the root question, it's possible, but it is extremely difficult to get lost in the Batona Trail. It's marked like no other trail I've ever seen. So that does really help with wayfinding. It's 53 miles can be a long way to go, but they do a very good job of making sure that you don't go off trail.
Yeah, it sounds really well marked. I do the same thing. Like a lot of the trails in Pennsylvania have mile markers, not half miles, but they have mile markers and they're like on the trees. And I definitely do my best to like not see them. I'm like, I don't want to know every mile. Like,
yes. Yep. I play a lot of mental games to in any ultra I do, whether it's flipping away from a certain screen on my watch so I don't even accidentally see the time or the distance. Or yeah, if I see that tree with that half mile mark coming up, I look down, I look to the side, I just avoid it. I know obviously a half mile has passed, but I try to lose myself within the middle of the adventure rather than you can drive yourself crazy thinking half mile to half mile to half mile.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think I read this on your profile that you're a running coach, right?
Yes.
So what kind of, as a coach, like what kind of training did you do for this? Obviously, you did some recon missions, but what does your training look like for like a 50 plus mile long unsupported run?
Yeah. So, and I am an ultra running coach, but I have been and still continue to be coached myself, which I think I've had that question posed to me, like, well, now that you're a coach, why do you still have a coach? But knowing myself, I need that accountability. I need that someone checking in. It also takes that piece of my life sort of off my plate where someone else is programming for me and helping me grow as an athlete while I can also do the same for others. So I work with my coach, his name is Scott Treyer, and worked with him for about 3 years. So for building up to this, we'd really come out of a period of time where I didn't have any races scheduled. I wrapped up 2023. We had just been focusing on building up some endurance and some speed and just kind of maintaining. And then once we decided to do the Batona Trail, I ran about 5 days a week, usually between 30 to 50 mile weeks, nothing super huge or I guess like quote unquote excessive. I think I keep it very, very modest. That's what works for me with like my life and my schedule. And then leading up to the races, we got closer. One thing we always do when we're really keying in on a race is a couple months out, all of my long runs are meant to be, I think he calls them course, it's like course specific, gear specific, like mentally specific. So everything is geared to be basically a dress rehearsal for the race. So even if I wasn't able to get down to the trail, I was able to go down and test out three different areas of the trail leading up. But even if I wasn't, if I was here running in, you know, in my backyard, I have the Wissahickon in Philly. So if I was doing that, I was still carrying a fully loaded pack. I had all my water, all my gear, as if I were to be going running Petona, even if I was still doing it up here in Philly. And I found that that's extremely helpful to even just prep your body for the weight of carrying a heavy pack, but also to go through a dress rehearsal and make sure that all your gear is working and that everything is as it should be. Sometimes you think you have the perfect, let's say, sports bra, but then it chafes you on one random run. And now you know you need to kind of go back to the drawing board and figure something out. Or you think you know exactly your nutrition plan and something turns your stomach. And then I kind of run that back. So that way I'm as prepared as possible when race day comes.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a great strategy. So kind of to wrap up, I'd love to hear maybe this kind of goes back to the things we were talking about at the beginning, but like, what was your biggest takeaway from doing this?
I think my biggest takeaway was, despite being someone, and I don't think this has changed about myself, it's who I am as a person. So despite being someone who really thrives off of external energy and support and loves the crowds and races and aid stations, I learned that there's still so much inside of me that is able to keep myself going. While I do love that external motivation, I think my internal motivation and my internal drive is a lot stronger than I ever thought. And I think stronger than maybe I was giving myself credit for. I was able to hit a low moment, you know, as a lot of us do when we're at that just past halfway mark. And I could feel my head spiraling. I wasn't going to give up, but my head was just, I wasn't in it. And I just sat myself down on the side of the trail and talked myself through it internally. I probably talked out loud a little bit, but I gave myself that motivation and I gave myself that external support. And seeing that come within me, it just like I said before, it really mentally, I could see like that door opening and I could feel like I was stepping into a whole other realm of what I was capable of. And experiencing that, I think, was really special. And that's a huge reason why I hope continuing to set some of these, like I like to call, first known times, I really hope it inspires other folks to do the same, because the things that you learn about yourself out on the trail, I can't say it enough. It's truly magical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree 100%. Absolutely. So for anybody that is like inspired by this, that wants to go out and maybe not set an FKT, but goes out and experience the Petona Trail, or, you know, push their limits in a first known time or something, you know, outside their comfort zone, like that's a different style. What sort of advice would you give them?
First piece of advice is reach out to your community. So if you have a route in mind, if you have something you're interested in, check out the FKT website, see if people have already set a time, reach out to them. I've had so many people, as soon as I reach out, are more than happy to share a huge wealth of knowledge, things that worked for them, things that didn't work for them, areas that you should know have a difficult turn. So I think first and foremost, reach out to your community. This trail, ultra, FKT world is filled with so many people that we're not trying to gatekeep an FKT from people. I think for the most part, we want people to take down a certain time we've set. We want to encourage others to get out there and explore. So reach out to your community and seek advice, be open and honest. And I think challenge yourself, try something that maybe feels a little outside your comfort zone, maybe feels a little scary, because that's where you really learn so much about yourself and find those magical moments.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing with us. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you so much. I, again, really appreciate the opportunity to share and to chat more about fun adventures out in the woods.
Thanks again, Rachel, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow her adventures on Instagram at Rachel_Lynn07.